Welcome to the Diary 101 podcast. I am your host, Aka Kandelo Kandepwe, also known as Aka. It's another day, it's another dollar. It's one of my favorite months, which is October. It's summer in Zambia, so it's really, really hot and humid. But hey, I'm such a summer girl, so something for me to I have been looking forward to is summer this year. With that being said, today's guest is somebody I have been looking forward to having on the podcast. I think that one of my favorite things is talking to strangers, and I've harnessed this skill using the podcast because the most random things happen and the most people I don't expect to be hosting are here. So it's something that I hope you enjoy. And yeah, with that being said, today's guest is Steven. Hi, Steven.
Hello, good afternoon.
Good morning.
Thank you. Yes, it's early here.
I know you're in the U.S. What state are you in?
I'm in Texas, sort of right in the middle.
Oh, yeah. I like Texas.
Where have you been?
I have been to Kansas, New York, Chicago, D.C., and St. Louis.
Okay, so you've traveled pretty well, or not bad. Yes,
I try.
That's awesome.
But you have so many states, so I still have a long way to go.
This is true. I've lived most of my life in New York, California, and DC.
Oh, nice. I like DC. I always say it smells conspiracy. And maybe because this is just me being delusional and all the movies I've watched about DC. But
yeah. I'm sure all the movies are not entirely wrong.
True. But I've also realized when I was in the US that 75% of what Hollywood shows us isn't true. Maybe DC could be like a little bit true, but everything else is like, is this really real? So when I was there, I was like, okay, this is very different from what I saw on TV. Very different.
But yeah, I'd like to think that the best movies have a truth about life, but the settings are often lies, you know? Hopefully there's some truth about human nature, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know. You got to make them fun, so you invent a bit.
I get it. So how best do you describe yourself when you meet somebody new?
When I meet somebody new, I usually describe myself as a person who is working to be in service of others who are trying to do something. And my background, people are like, well, you know, what have you done? I've been a software engineer at IBM. I have been a senior executive at two motion picture studios on the DreamWorks lot and the 20th Century Fox lot. And now I have founded a tech company that's a flow state app that helps people get into that, you know, deep, concentrated kind of flow state. And that's what I do. But I guess my most fun thing is that I love just helping people do what they're capable of.
I love that. How did you get to transitioning into building your own tech company?
Well, when I was at DreamWorks, I was there for 4 years. I was an executive vice president for Kurtzman Orsi at the DreamWorks lot. And that was the era of the Transformers movies and Star Trek and stuff like that. And it was super fun. Like, it was a great studio run by a filmmaker, you know, trying to make things at a very high quality. I went from there to Fox. I got recruited by Fox, and the appeal of that was, you know, they were very generous with salary, and they said they would let me run the Die Hard and Wolverine franchises and stuff like that. And I went there, and I realized it was a very big value misalignment. Like, the way in which they worked and their ethics were very different than mine. And so I decided to get out, and the thing that appealed to me was to go and do something where I had more control, which really meant going to a startup. So that was the big impetus for me to say, okay, you know, I think I'm done making sequels and prequels. Most of my friends and I that were in film, you know, we were all working on Marvel franchises, Pixar franchises, Lucasfilm stuff, where you're just doing like the 19th version of some small character and their backstory. And, you know, it's show business, but it's not really meaningful. So that was it for me.
I get it. I just want to say I'm a Marvel fan.
Great. Yeah, there's some fun movies in there.
I am always rewatching Transformers. It's very easy. I think from 2015 going below, the movies just stick. I think that now, I rarely watch a movie twice, right?
Yeah.
I would rather go back and watch Iron Man, Transformers, anything from the older movies. And it's like a very interesting shift because you'd be expecting that we would be so fixated on the current movies, and I'm just like, oh no, I don't want to watch this, I want to watch the next thing. So when you're in the movie industry, I know now you're not in the movie industry, what shifts have you seen?
What have I seen?
The shifts with how the consumption with movies.
Oh, what shifts have I seen? Oh, I'll tell you, it's very obvious, which is as the budgets of the movies have gotten bigger over the past, 20, 25 years, the risk to the studio has gone up. So to mitigate that risk, they really just want to make movies that have a built-in audience. So making Iron Man 19 or Ant-Man 7 is a safer bet for them than trying to make something new and interesting. And audiences often complain about, oh, it's all the same remakes and sequels and prequels and, this kind of garbage. But the thing is, the audiences vote for that because they're the ones who are going to see them. So the studios really don't care what they make. They just want to know that there's an audience for what they make. So you kind of get what you vote for. So that's the biggest shift, really, is the movies are just made to reduce risk. So that's why you see all sequels.
That's interesting. When you look back to your life, take me back to how your career came about.
I started out, my parents were both engineers. My dad was still is a hardware engineer designing essentially logic circuits like CPUs. And my mom was a software engineer at IBM. And so I learned to code when I was little. And that led to when I was going to college, I was a Watson scholar, which is IBM's like highest scholarship. And that guaranteed me a job at IBM. So I worked as a software engineer at IBM to make money. And while I was in college, university in Los Angeles, my school has one of the best cinema TV schools in the world. And a lot of your friends, in the dorm are in the cinema TV school. So I saw a lot of movies and learned a lot about film. And that happened to turn into my first jobs getting out of school were producing computer generated graphics for film because I understood computers. And then I had a little bit of a cinematic vocabulary. So that was my entree into film. And then after doing a number of movies there, Independence Day, True Lies, Braveheart, stuff like that, I decided I wanted to actually make all of a movie, not just the digital part of a movie. And that was a very different career because then you're working with writers more and you're trying to find material. And I did that. I worked up that ladder. That's where I went to DreamWorks and Fox. And then at Fox, I had that moment of just the movies I'm working on are meaningless. It's just you're making Die Hard 5 solely to make money. There's no idea behind it. And that was my moment to say, okay, I think I need to get out of here. And so that's when I went and I was like, okay, I'm going to go find some problems I can solve with technology, which is the thing that I knew, and go start a tech company. And that's basically how I started the Sukha company. Sukha is Sanskrit for happiness. Was I learned about flow states and this magical sort of way of getting into a focused state to do your work faster and better. And then at the end of it, feeling like in control, feeling happier, feeling a sense of joy, as opposed to feeling depleted. And that brings me to today. And then here we are in our podcast.
Let's talk about Suka, right? Remote work is something that is emerging very quickly, and a lot of organizations are giving a leeway to their employees to have that hybrid kind of life where you physically go to the office, you work remotely, sometimes you work hybrid, you work remotely, and some organizations are like, hey, as long as you're getting the work done, we are okay with you working from wherever you want. So for you to create Suka, you kind of saw the challenges people were facing to get into this new emerging trend. Can we just talk about some of the top three challenges you noticed with remote working?
Yeah, and I'll tell you, let's be super honest here.
Yeah.
It is not noticed with, it is problems that I have. You know, I'm as afflicted with these problems as anyone. So I'll tell you in a very personal way, things that, you know, bad habits that I have. One of them is I procrastinate, period, right? And I found it would be like this. Hey, Aka, you know, tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., I really need to write this blog post or I need to do whatever work, right? And at 9:15, I would still be returning some emails that were maybe not that important, or I was at 9:30 scrolling the news just to see what's going on or something, right? And I wouldn't get going at 9. And I looked at it and I asked myself, why am I doing this? Because then it ends up at the end of the day, I haven't finished my work, and that's frustrating. And I realized I procrastinated because I was overwhelmed. And it was either overwhelmed because I knew there were so many things when I stared at my task list, that there's no way I could get them all done. So it's almost like paralyzing. Or there's something on there that was so big, that was like write my book or something, you know, that I couldn't even make a dent in that in the time I had that morning. So it became daunting. So that procrastination was a big one for me. Another one was during the day, distraction, where, yeah, I'd be working and for a moment I'd pick up my phone, and then that turned into checking WhatsApp, which then turned into going over to my email or TikTok or something and watching some videos and just, you know, the frustration at the end of the day being like, oh, wow, I didn't do the things I needed to do. So those were really hard. And sometimes motivation was another problem that I had, which is just how to, you know, get up the energy to get going. And so really Suka was my response to my own problems, to say, how can I solve my procrastination? How can I solve, you know, my distraction? How can I solve, you know, my motivation? And I can tell you how I solved it, but that's really where Suka came from.
That's interesting. Were you in between projects when you came up with Suka? Or was it something that you just was like, I'm ready to do something and solve my problems right now?
You know, it was a buddy of mine was an engineer at Groupon. And he had asked me to co-found a company with him to do a mindful to-do list app, is how he described it. And I said I didn't want to do that with him because I didn't have some secret on how to make to-do list apps work. You know, I'd used a bunch of them. I had abandoned them. Like, they're sort of whatever. And I told him, you know, I love you. I'll still help you. Like, if you need help, I'll help you. But I don't want to be responsible for co-founding this because I don't have some brilliant idea how to do that. And about a year or so into helping him as like a side project, he said to me, he was, his wife is pregnant. He's going to have a baby. And he said, you know, I think I need to go get, you know, a real job at a big company and that sort of thing and pay for the child. And I said to him this, I had discovered flow states at that time. And I said, I would love to buy our code base because I think I could actually use that as a foundation to write something I'm coming to believe in very deeply, which is there is a value in having, you know, this ability to focus and get my work done sooner, because that's a problem I actually have. So that's how it came about, is I bought the code base, ended up with a buddy of mine, Tony, in Vancouver, Canada, rewriting the entire thing. Like, we ended up throwing out that code because it was not that great, but it was a good starting point. and use that to create Suka, you know? So that's kind of how it came about, thanks to a buddy of mine.
That's interesting. I just want to put this out here. Do you see how like most stuff come out from the most unexpected things? You were just helping out your buddy because he wanted to come up with an app that helped with tasks, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, kind of that. I'll tell you, I find that it's the relationships that are the most important. Like a lot of the good things in my life have come from, you know, the friends that I have, whether it's ideas in film or new jobs in film or, you know, working in tech. I don't think I've ever gotten a job because I applied for it. I think every job I've had has been, you know, I'm working on something and at some point, you know, a friend like Akka is like, oh, you know what? I would love your help in doing this thing. Or, you know, I have a friend who really would love to work with you. And that's how most of my stuff comes up.
So it always goes back to how friendships and relationships are always the fundamental of a lot of things that we do. I also agree because most of the stuff I get to do, it's not because I'm the right person for the job. It's always, hey, I feel like this would be a good fit for you. And that's always my friends, like at any given point. Like, oh my goodness, I saw something and it would so work for you. So just listening to you speak about you and your buddy.
That's really cool. Can I ask you a question? I'm so curious. Sure. I always want to learn. So when you have work to do, what are the biggest obstacles for you? Like, do you procrastinate? Do you get distracted? Distracted by what? Like, do you have a lack of motivation? Like, what are the problems you experience?
I just get distracted easily.
Yeah.
I get very distracted if I touch my phone, if I get a call. So one thing about me is my phone is always on do not disturb because
good.
I get a lot of calls. And it's also offending for the other people on the other end because they don't understand why their call gets cut. But they call at the wrong time. So I get distracted easily and I also procrastinate. So it's those two combinations for me. What I have done is, and I forget easily. I get distracted and I forget easily. So if I'm supposed to book an appointment, a podcast session, if I don't do it then and then, I will forget and maybe only remember after 2 days when I'm going through my emails. I'm like, oh, I really did forget to book that session. So what I have done with my work is I have time slots. So I know from 10 to 1, I'm doing something. I'm going to take a break. From 2 to 5, I'm doing different stuff. But I think one thing that has changed my life is a calendar. Is Calendly. Because Calendly now, people can just put themselves on my calendar.
So right, yeah.
That's been like a game changer because then I don't really have to worry about people being... I don't have to worry about booking somebody. It's always, hey, you could just get a slot on any available day and I will see you there. So yeah, it's a lot of that. And now just taking time off with my phones. I know when to be online, not when to be online. And also I delete certain apps.
Ooh, like what?
TikTok.
Smart.
I log off my Instagram from all devices.
Yep.
Yeah. And I only watch Netflix in the night for like 45 minutes before I sleep or before I meditate before I sleep. So it's a lot of the in-betweens in my life where I'm just like, okay, I'm not going to do this at this point. I'm not going to pick up a call. I will not text back. Like, I won't have this meeting at this time. So, yeah. That's how I kind of have created a little system around myself. I could do better, but I am.
No, I love that you're so aware of how social media works. I'll tell you, Laura, my wife and I have a bunch of friends that either are at one of the Meta companies, you know, or have been there, and Twitter and TikTok really are the big ones. And, you know, you get that inside view of exactly what they talk about and how they think of, you know, their users. It is very interesting. Like, I'm going to have my first child in 5 weeks, 5 weeks from today, as a matter of fact.
Congratulations.
And thank you. Super excited. And I'll tell you, I've been thinking a lot of one of the reasons I've been doing more free speaking, like without a fee this year, is just to share some knowledge into the world that I know my children will inherit. And I'll tell you, I think about how their generation will perceive us. And I hope that they look at social media and our generation the way I look at my father's generation with smoking, where I talk to my dad, I'm like, you know, you've seen three of your friends die of lung cancer, like you have emphysema. And my dad's point of view is, you know, when I was young, smoking was cool and all the movie stars did it in the films. And, you know, the tobacco companies put out studies how healthy tobacco was. We just didn't know. And I wonder if our kids will look at this era and they'll be like, okay, so you wasted your life watching Kim Kardashian create ads for her underwear line and get 50 million likes. So you watched a woman make ads for underwear and you considered that like a good use of your life, you know? It's kind of remarkable because, you know, when you, I've listened to several episodes of your podcast, and I think it's awesome that you are getting people to talk about, okay, here's my journey. Here are the inflection points. Here are the times I had trouble. Here's how I navigated it. You know, you're asking me about, you know, how did relationships help me on my way? And I'll tell you this. It is the biggest threat that I see, because I run about a 34,000 person membership of people who are all, you know, working to be focused and trying to do something with their life and have more time, you know, to do other things. And when you talk about social media and how big a distraction it is amazing, because if you fundamentally believe that everyone has something inside them, something great that they could get out, whether it's writing the next great novel or starting a restaurant or creating an app or, you know, starting a company, whatever, right? Then you have to realize that in order for them to do that, they have to win the tug of war. And on one side of the tug of war, you have these trillion-dollar companies whose business model is simply steal your life. And they're very upfront about it. If you listen to the shareholder calls, they talk about how much time they stole from everyone's lives and what new techniques they're going to use next quarter to steal more time to drive the share price up. And wow. If you think about, if Mark Zuckerberg were to call you up and say, Aka, listen, I would like your life and I'm going to sell it to these advertisers over here and I'm going to keep the money. But I'm going to give you these dancing cat videos. Is that cool, Aka? Is that a good trade for your life? You know? And it sounds ridiculous when you say it that way, but that is exactly what they're doing. So they're on one side of this tug of war with all this money to buy the best designers, the best engineers, you know, the best behavioral economists to put on staff. And the other side of that tug of war rope is you all alone trying to pull to do something with your life. And that, I think, is possibly the biggest problem, the biggest challenge of our generation. I mean, there's climate change. There's obviously some of the fascism, the rise of the fascism, stuff like that, which are horrible. But those are somewhat, we have ideas how to get out of them, and I hope we do. But with the social media, it's just getting worse every day. It's more and more of the best techniques are being used to ensure that no one does the great thing of which they're capable. And that's the thing that worries me more than anything, you know, and that's what Laura and I talk about a bunch with our kids. So like you talk about deleting TikTok or limiting your Instagram usage. We're talking about just not having our kids on social media, like period. It's just like poison. It's like becoming an alcoholic.
That's so true. And I think I had somebody on the podcast. She's from New York as well. And we had this conversation, and I think one of the conversations I have with my married friends is, don't have your kids on the internet, right? We have this unspoken rule where I rarely share any of my nieces and nephews on the internet.
Good.
When they are just at a year, 5 years, 10 years. And I have a younger sister, she's 12, and she had a phone, she had an iPad. 2 years ago, it got damaged. And I was like, I'm not gonna replace this iPad because technically I don't see the use of you having an iPad. Like on my end, there's no use for a 12-year-old to have an iPad. We know where you are all the time. You're at school, you're at home, you're at church. So it's those conversations that are very uncomfortable. But I think that as parents, as soon to be parents, everybody needs to start having those conversations. What are the things we're not going to let our kids have? Mm-hmm. Because we know it's unsafe. It's also very unsafe to have your kid on the internet. Like, a lot happens on the internet. So every time I see kids on TikTok, I'm like, a lot happens on TikTok. Do you want your kid influenced like that? Because then, a long time ago, the only thing you really had to worry about where your kid gets influenced from is school or church. Everything else was controlled. But imagine now you're putting them in an uncontrolled environment, which is the internet, and you get to actually pay for it. So, like, you're paying to destroy your kid, like you said. Like, you're really paying to have somebody feel unsafe and everything. So, yeah, I think it's something I'm very conscious about, is like, really, do I really want, if I have kids in the future, do I really want them on the internet? And when is it the right time to start having those conversations?
These are real questions to wrestle with. I agree. And what happens when they're like, oh, but mommy, you know, all my friends have cell phones. My friends are on Instagram and TikTok. What are you going to say?
Oh, you don't live with your friends. This is not your friend's house, darling.
Right? That's true. It's good.
Yeah, I think I think we take this very lightly as generations. Like, we're not really taking it as serious as it gets. Because you are responsible for your child's emotional and financial experiences. So you really can't leave that to a company. And again, every person on the internet is a dollar. And for a kid, I think it's a dollar. I don't know how much it is for us adults, but I know a kid is like a dollar on the internet. So do you really want your child to be valued that way?
Wow. Yeah.
I think it's a very interesting question, and I hope it... I know, because I'm probably part of the future parents in the next few years.
Yeah, so yeah.
When are we going to have this conversation? I probably think it's like one of my rules where I'm just like, hey, we're not having my kid on the internet. So if you're taking a picture of my kid, you really can't post them.
Yeah.
Let them do that at 16, at 18. Yeah, maybe. Another too soon. Because, again, I see... Let's also think about the implications of technology right now, right? It's really hyped up the past few years, like really rapidly in the last 10 years. But I didn't get to have a phone and be on Facebook till I was 15. And I can now... Right. I can imagine the impact technology has had with me negatively and positively. So if it took us as a generation a while to actually be on the internet, why do you think a lot of people are letting their kids be on the internet earlier on, but they went on the internet?
Sorry?
I'm saying, why do you think that a lot of parents are letting their kids be on the internet early on, like join social media, have access to all these tools, when they didn't even experience them till later in their teen life?
I think it's two reasons. One, sometimes it's just not a considered decision. It's just, oh, well, you know, we're on the internet, they should be on the internet. It's not they think deeply how this will affect their children. I think there's a set of parents who are just like, well, the internet is here, so everyone should use it. And not considering that for a 6-year-old or 8-year-old, it might be a different experience than for a 30-year-old. And the other thing is, I do think that you have parents who think about it and that they think, well, I want my child to be, you know, internet literate. I don't want them to be, you know, the only one that doesn't know how to use the internet or use Google to find answers or something. So it's hard in how you put guardrails up because, man, the stories you hear are sometimes very scary about how what adults do to children on the internet. And, you know, I hope that we continue to evolve and come up with smart ways to handle it because it's on our minds a lot. Laura and my minds a lot, you know, given we're having a child in November.
Well, again, congratulations on the child.
Thank you. Yeah, super, super excited.
Yes, I also think it's the two things where no one really, some just are not thinking about it and others just don't want to, they don't want their kids to feel left out. So it's just that for them.
Yeah.
You've been in the tech industry and for a while now, actually, I think that's been most of your career. Yeah, coder. I always like to say that the experience of technology in Africans and in the Western countries is very different. You're from the US. When I say that it's very different, we are probably a century behind. Like, it's very, very, the experience is very different. What you have access to and what you experience is very different from what we have access to and what we experience, because I'm in Zambia and it's a developing country.
Mm-hmm.
On your end, what are some of the emerging trends when it comes to technology?
Oh, I mean, let me explain a little bit about what people are calling artificial intelligence, which is artificial intelligence is a general term for a lot of kinds of computational, you know, work that's done. And large language models, which are very much in the zeitgeist right now, are one type of AI, right? But a lot of what people don't understand right now about large language models, and specifically the pre-trained transformers, is that they're not actually thinking. And one of the big debates right now is that you can interact with a large language model and it gives you back a response that seems to be very human. However, what you have to understand is that the large language model is not actually thinking the way a human would. What the large language model is doing is it's saying, okay, I have been fed petabytes of data of what people write about and say. So I've developed a probability weight. The same way, if you ever use Google autocomplete, if you ever like typing in a Gmail and it says the next word should be plural or something and it knows to add an S, right?
Yeah.
LLMs are really just like a glorified version of that Google autocomplete. They just say, oh, Akka's writing, I looked out the window and it looks and it thinks, okay, well, there's a 30% chance the next word is rainy. There's a 25% chance the next word is sunny. You know, I've learned this from studying all these, my data set, my training set, and just assigning weights to things, guesses, probabilities. So it does that with both words as well as ideas. And that's what it regurgitates. So that is one of the big conversations right now, saying like, as much as this is interesting, are people misunderstanding how it deeply works? And is there a better way of doing it? There's another way. The acronym is OAK. And I'm trying to remember what the acronym stands for, but it's essentially another AI scientist saying, I think this would be better and closer to thought if instead of training the LLM on everything you can scrape off the internet and just saying, hey, figure out what words, ideas come after other words. What if you were to start from zero? And what if you had a brain like a child who was able to learn from mistakes? And you started it out with the understanding it will say random answers and make mistakes, but it will start to learn as you correct it, as it interacts with people. And that might actually, in the long run, be a better approximation of how thought works in humans than guessing from a probability engine the next idea. So that's a popular conversation over here, especially in tech.
That's interesting. I think one conversation I've also heard is kind of what is going to be the job shift. So some careers might just fade off and new careers might come in. So I kind of want to know, what's the view on your end? And since, because you own a remote company that works with people that do remote work, are some of the careers that you think might phase off, and how do you think the transition will look like?
Well, whether we're using LLMs the way they're created now or another kind of artificial intelligence, a lot of the jobs that do rote work are going to be gone. You know, it's the same thing with a lot of manual jobs where we're developing humanoid robots that can do those repetitive sort of activities. So that that does speak to, you know, a good question around what happens when you don't have to do those kind of rote manual jobs or rote, knowledge work jobs. And hopefully creativity and thought are more prized, but there is a conversation here in Silicon Valley around, do we need to adjust how we think of, employment? Because fundamentally, AI might be able to, machines might be able to do a lot of these jobs now, cheaper and more reliably. So that's a big one. I would say lean into the things that humans can still do better for the moment, which is often creativity,
Yeah, true. No matter what happens, nothing can replace a human being in terms of just giving that human experience. But it's also going to be interesting if we're proved wrong.
We will see. It's going to be interesting.
See in a few months or a year. We might get proved wrong. You are leading a company. So What's the best way to lead and build a team?
I think that as a leader, there are two important things you have to do. And there are a number of other things, like you have to raise money and you have to, take care of things internally, right? But there are two big things. One is you have to clearly articulate your mission. You have to be able to say, we are here to cure cancer, or we're here to, make, cars that have no emissions. We are here to, make romantic comedy movies or whatever it is. But you have to clearly articulate, this is why we're here. And you have to be able to articulate, what is the value system? How do we treat each other? How do we treat our customers? How do we treat our competitors? Because if you do those two things well, then your hiring process attracts the people who are value aligned with your company. And some of the biggest successes I've had have been because I did a great job of hiring the right people around me. And some of the failures I've had is when I hired someone who sounded great or came with a great recommendation or things like that, but they weren't actually they weren't value aligned. And I'll give you an example of that is if you as a leader are saying, oh, here's why we're here, here's how we're going to treat each other, right? And someone comes to you who might have great qualifications, but you see on their resume, they've had 5 jobs in 6 years. They keep jumping job to job, getting a better salary. You can intuit from that or infer from that that they're probably not deeply connected to the jobs that they choose. There are other reasons, right? Which may be money, it may be schedule, it may be flexibility, it may be, getting a better title. And if you hire them, you're kind of an idiot, unless you need someone for a few months who's just going to do something surgically and leave. Like, they clearly don't choose companies where they're deeply invested in the mission. However, if you run a remote team, for example, one of the fears that I hear from leaders is, well, you know, I can't see Aka at 3 p.m. on Tuesday. How do I know she's not at the beach? How do I know she's not playing with her dog? How do I, you know, she's not, I think you love to go hiking and, you know, go to the outdoors. How do I know she's not hiking on Tuesday afternoons, right? And that goes away if I clearly articulate, hey, we're here to cure cancer. We're going to treat each other this way. And you come to me and you say, you know what, I just finished, you know, this degree, my med degree or whatever, my biosciences, I'm interested in oncology. And, you know, my grandfather died of lung cancer or something. On Tuesday afternoon at 3 o'clock, I don't need to see you. I know that you're working to move the ball downfield because you care about the mission. And that's, I think, really important about being a leader is to say, I need to attract the people in this company who want to be here. And that starts with me saying why we're here. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. It does make sense. And I think a lot of organizations as well should reach a point where understanding the different types of workforces they have and the different generations and the different seasons their workforce or their teams are in. So some people might just be doing it for the money, which I think should also just be okay. Some might have reached a point where they need stability and the flexibility. Others have reached a point in their life where they are here for the impact. They see the vision for what it is and they want to be part of it. That's where they are. And I think as a leader, just understanding that aspect of everybody's life is what that could do as well. So I thought of adding that on.
This is true. This is true.
You mentioned.
So what else is on your mind this afternoon?
A lot. A lot is always on my mind. But it's all good. We're speaking about impact and shifting mindsets. So what advice would you have for young people in terms of the impact and mindset shift in this technological era and how we are also experiencing artificial intelligence?
So it is very simple, and we've mentioned this on the pod, which is if you make the decision that you have something inside you that is great, if you say, yes, I recognize that I want to be a great runner, a great writer, a great inventor, a great scientist, a great whatever, then you need to decide that you don't want to end up 80 years old. That person who says, oh, well, I could have been a great runner. I could have written that book. I could have started that company. And it's very easy to give your life up to these social media companies, and you will be that 80-year-old person on the sofa that's miserable, just scrolling, double tapping. And no one wants to be around you. It's miserable to know that person. So when you decide, hopefully you do decide, that you want to actually release what's inside you, that great thing, bring it into the world and change the world in whatever way that it does, you need to have discipline and tools to block out these apps that are like, it's like ice cream. It's like opening your phone and it's just like a stream of, you know, vanilla and chocolate ice cream coming at you through Instagram and, you know, TikTok and Twitter and these platforms. So that is my biggest advice, is if you decide you're one of the people who's not going to die grumpy complaining, then take the steps now to block these apps that just monetize your life. They steal your life.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's, you have to be very intentional about what you put into your life. They always say that you're a reflection of the five people you hang around with. At this point, the five people are always apps.
Yeah, it's true, right?
So it's like, what are the five apps I'm always hanging around with?
You got to watch out. You got to watch out. That's a very good way of looking at it. Yeah, I like that. Like,
what are these apps doing to me?
Yeah.
Right now in this moment. So yeah, I totally agree. What's like the biggest challenge you have faced so far in your career business, and how have you navigated it?
Biggest challenge has probably been knowing when something is working, when something is not working, but it will work, and knowing when something is not working and you need to move on. I think there's a battle, and I've experienced it in my life, between tenacity is very important, to have resilience and to take failure and to say, let me learn from that and continue on. That is a great quality. But you have to couple that with knowing when to take input and say, I need to change what I'm doing, or maybe, you know, drastically revise the path that I'm on. I have happily worked on things that did not work initially. And by listening to people who were telling me that it didn't work, I've been able to figure out what part of it to change. So it did become a movie, or it did become, you know, a platform. And there are other times when I think I've held on too long to something, not believing that I should move on. But sometimes it is hard when you're in the middle of it to know which is which, whether it's going to work if you keep at it or if you're wasting your time. And I don't have a brilliant solution to that, because there's so many inputs to determine, is this going to work or not? You know?
No, I get it. I can definitely relate. I think one of my biggest challenges, if I may mention, is for me is knowing when to let go. Like, when is it the right time for me to move on? Like, am I being resilient enough, or am I just letting go easily? Because I detach very easily as well. As much as I experience attachment easily, I can just say, hey, this is done, I'm grateful, and I'm done. So that scenario, when it comes to work relationships, I'm just like, when is it really the right time? Because also as a Gen Z, we're living through the bias of whatever decisions we make are always like, you're such a Gen Z. So it's like we're always gaslighted in rethinking our decisions. So it's very, yeah, I can totally relate to that.
Yeah.
Steven, I want to give you an opportunity to ask me a question.
Yeah, I'm curious, when you and I were talking about why you do this podcast, and you said you love having people share their journeys and helping other people hear, you know, how, you know, careers get navigated. Why did you think of a podcast when you thought, oh, I think that this is a valuable idea? How did you choose in what medium you did that? Why not a blog? Why not a YouTube channel? Why did you choose a podcast?
Because I always have good conversations with people. So I realized that the past few years before I started the podcast, I would be on a call with a friend and would speak for hours. Mm-hmm. And I saw the type of impact that had for me, how I looked at things differently, how I navigated stuff differently. So initially, I always was insecure to have a podcast. I always thought that there's nothing I can do with a podcast. Like, I'm not good enough to have a podcast. Like, listen to me speak, this, that, the whole scenario. But then after my trip to America, I realized, say, hey, I could really do this and still mess up and it'd still be okay. So that's why the podcast, I feel like I'm really good at, I was told actually, that I'm really good at talking to people that I know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm really good at making conversations. So why not invest so much in that and have conversations with people? So it took me a while to accept that I'm good at conversating with people. Also took me a while to accept it. And then eventually having a podcast where I'm like, okay, yeah, I really am good at conversating with people. Let me conversate with people and let me see how it's going. So that's why, and I think I mentioned earlier that the conversations were really good. Like, I always came out of the conversations, I'm like, oh, damn, I wish somebody else was there. Someone my age could listen to this person speak. they would get so much knowledge and power, and they would navigate stuff differently. So the more I had the conversations, the more I was like, I really want other people my age or my generation to hear this person speak. So yeah, like creating a platform that does that is very fulfilling, actually. Yeah.
Gosh, it's very cool. I am so glad we had this chance to talk this morning. I mean, this afternoon for you. I hope this has been
morning for you.
Yeah, morning, exactly. Almost 8 a.m. now. I hope this has been helpful. And I hope if people are listening that this maybe get them some thoughts on how, you know, different people have navigated their careers. And this is mine.
Yes, I like this as well. My last question for you is, what do you look forward to?
Oh my God, I'm having a son in 5 weeks. I'm super excited. that's number one. I mean, my company, the Suka Company, I love it. It's a flow state app. It helps people, you know, to get into concentrated states. It's super fun. But the number one thing on my mind right now is, you know, our house is full of little baby gifts and, you know, getting ready to clean baby bottles and silly stuff like that. So I'm really excited.
That is something to look forward to, and I am very excited on your behalf as well. I think that I like being an aunt. I always say this to everybody in my life that is settled and they have a family. I'm like, I like being an aunt to your kids. So if there's one thing that makes me very excited, are kids. I think they're the most genuine human beings on earth. So yeah, I'm very excited for you. Again, congratulations.
Thank you so much. And thank you for having me, and everyone who listened, thank you for being here with us.
Yes, and for everybody listening, I hope you enjoyed this conversation between Stephen and I. Share it with a friend, comment, follow us on our work. With that being said, bye for now.